and are very...
Sorry to interrupt Uncle Don there, but this is Uncle Don. Good morning, Prince George. This is Uncle Don with show number 25 for the 11th of September 2002. Another week closer to Bush Light's coming criminal war. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM, blasting out to Greater Prince George in almost 5 big watts. At that power, they should be picking me up on their fillings in Hickson. The name of the show is Uncle Don Reads the Comics. This has nothing to do with reading comics, but that's fine because I'm not Uncle Don. Uncle Don damn near didn't make it to the show today, slipping on the ice out there on Highway 97. Gordon Campbell's cut back on his expenses highway department, so there's no sand trucks out. Today has been 15 months since the World Trade Center and Pentagon stunts. So, for a year and a quarter, the mightiest nation on Earth has been putting all of the resources at its disposal into the capture or murder of Osama bin Laden. And the results? Osama sends recorded messages to Bush Light. The country of Afghanistan has been restored to the warlords and drug merchants, and Iraq is about to be attacked again. Net results, bin Laden 1, son of Bush 2. Bin Laden got his score not just from knocking down two of the ugliest buildings in the United States and damaging a third. Osama managed to prompt the administration in the United States to attack those institutions that he hates, according to Little Bush. Bush said that bin Laden hates the Americans' freedom, openness, and tolerance. Scratch all three of those under the so-called anti-terrorist legislation. United States has been reduced to a quivering, paranoid land where anyone different is suspected of being a terrorist. Their freedom to travel, communicate, and be themselves is abridged. The openness is circumscribed by secrecy and fear. Their tolerance is dissolved. They are now being urged to spy upon one another. If you doubt who is winning the war on terror, look at what's happened to the United States over these last 15 months. A couple of weeks ago, I was ranting about the proposed agreement for military cooperation with the United States. This proposed agreement would allow the troops of either country to enter the other if invited to assist in the event of terrorist attack or natural disaster. I was not satisfied with ranting. I wrote a reasoned letter to our Minister of Defense, John McCallum, explaining why I oppose such an agreement. My letter, of course, was short-stopped by a flunky, and I was sent a form letter reply. I know how this works, as it was once my job to answer letters like this for an official in the provincial government. Thanks, the flunky. This letter refers to military cooperation with the United States. Ignore the content. Send the schmuck form letter 17B. Sign it for the minister. Next letter. My complaint, which was not addressed, is that when the United States is wanted to be invited into other countries, it has set up puppet governments to do the inviting. These governments in exile do the inviting, in go the troops, regardless of the wishes of the real rulers or the people of the country. When Theodore Roosevelt wanted to build the Panama Canal, the Isthmus of Panama was a part of Colombia. Colombia refused to allow it, so Roosevelt set up a puppet government in the state of Panama, then recognized that so-called government. The new government immediately allowed the United States to take over the canal zone. When Colombia dispatched ships to depose the rebels in Panama, the American Navy headed them off, and the rest is history. The United States was unhappy with the 1954 agreement between the defeated French forces and the victorious Vietnamese. In spite of that agreement, which stated clearly that the division of North and South Vietnam was to be for only 2 years until a nationwide election could be held, the United States set up a puppet government in the South, which it then recognized. As with Panama, the puppet government invited the United States to defend it. This defense cost the Vietnamese several million dead and the pain of a war that lasted for the next 21 years. So if the United States should become unhappy with a future government of Canada, what would prevent them from recognizing a government in exile that would then invite them to occupy this country? Could we expect our military to resist? I doubt it. First of all, they would be hopelessly overpowered. And secondly, our military is so integrated with the American military that it is questionable that Canada's generals would follow Ottawa's orders. They know which side of the bread the butter is on. We might find ourselves occupied by our own military under American rule. This happened in France in World War II when the Vichy government, a puppet of the Nazis, governed with French nationals as stooge administrators. Most Canadians think of the United States as a clumsy, overbearing, but benign neighbor, since we have been at peace with them since the War of 1812. But what would that benign neighbor do if a future government of Canada decided to stop exporting our oil or gas? Suppose there was a crunch in supply that threatened to cripple our transportation and industry. We could abrogate the so-called free trade agreements and allocate the production of energy for our own country. I suggest that such a move would end our peaceful relationship with the clumsy giant. We could well see the nasty side of that country in a hurry. This proposed agreement with the U.S. is a Trojan horse. Let us hope the negotiations on this come to nothing. But I think Chrétien will follow orders of his American masters, and we will be saddled with this agreement. May I be wrong on this one? By the way, the letter I referred to before was supposedly signed by John McCallum, our Minister of Defense. I noticed that this same man was prohibited from flying on Air Canada on the 3rd of November as he was pissed. He claims that he does not have a drinking problem. He only had a few glasses of wine with his mommy. From the condition in which I've seen some people board Air Canada flights, he must have been truly loaded to be bounced. Is our military posture determined by people who have fallen in the bottle? It was recently revealed that John Kennedy was taking multiple medications for back pain and other ailments at the time when his bravado damn near started World War III over the Cuban missiles. How many other world leaders are on chemical trips when they have their hands on the levers of power? Excuse me. Now some good news. UNBC has offered a handsome gift from abroad. It has just been leaked to Uncle Don that the Sultan of Brunei has offered our university a gift of about 12 million Canadian dollars to be used to build that much-needed new classroom building. The building that was to have been in place by now, but which has never been funded, was to house the classrooms that are now on the first floor of the Weller Library building. As it is, our library is sorely squeezed for space, and the new building will allow expansion of the stacks and other cramped services. The Sultan has attached only one condition to the donation of the new building. He wants the name of UNBC changed to the Saddam Hussein Institute of Technology. Officials of the university and the provincial government have been meeting during the last couple of weeks to discuss the proposal. Some federal government officials are afraid that the United States will be angry at such a name change. The provincial government is sensitive that a foreign government is offering to pay for a project that the province once promised to cover. And the university is afraid that students will shorten the name Saddam Hussein Institute of Technology to a four-letter term that will not be tech. As for Uncle Don, I have already made arrangements to sell the T-shirts. A recent article in the Guardian Weekly was entitled, Meet the New Zionists. This full-page article gives a fascinating British view of the United States political machinations, specifically as respect to support for Israel. It's been no secret that successive American administrations, Republican and Democrat, since the Truman era, have blindly supported the State of Israel. This support has been diplomatic, military, and economic, and has scarcely wavered without regard for any actions by Israel. According to the article, church attendance in the States runs to 40% as opposed to Britain's 2%. Some 15 to 18% of adult Americans describe themselves as religious conservatives. This group of voters provide a solid block that are the bedrock support of George Bush, Jr. He's one of them. He is either a true believer or a very astute politician. Let's go with the true believer. It fits better with the moron label. These religious conservatives are largely fundamentalist Christians who believe the Bible to be the revealed truth of their God, word for word. This bypasses the issue of which translation was authorized by their God, but they can pick what they want from any version, I suppose. They love the story of the rapture, where the faithful will be lifted up to heaven and the rest of us heathens will be left to our own devices until the late J. Christ returns to rule, etc., etc. Novels around this theme sell well, making their authors and the Jesus bookstores lots of money. The ninth volume of the Left Behind series, a run of mediocre tales built around the rapture, has just surpassed 3 million sales in the hardback edition. This eclipses the sales of John Grisham's novels. There are many people out there who swallow this stuff whole. I have a couple of fundamentalists in my extended family, but I don't brag about it. One of them asked me recently if a Jewish friend of mine was planning to go back to Israel. I replied that he'd never been to Israel, so he could scarcely return. Then I heard that one of the predictions that had to that had to be fulfilled before the return of the aforementioned J. Christ is that the Jews will return to Israel. My relative wondered if he should be packing a bag for heaven, I suppose. Another key prediction is that the Jews will convert to Christianity. The Jews of Israel will take the support, thank you, but reject the prospect of conversion. It is sad that a country with such great potential for doing good is being held hostage by 1 in 6 of its population. But these people are organized, they listen to their preachers, and they vote. While the apathetic majority find other things to do on election day, these religious monomaniacs determine the direction of the most powerful nation on earth. They can, and did, put in power a man of dubious moral and intellectual assets. They can dictate support for the criminal nation of Israel and write it a blank check to commit genocide and other war crimes. May they have their damned rapture soon and get out of our hair. Meanwhile, back in Canada, Roy Romano has tabled his report on the state of Medicare in Canada. The Globe and Mail came out with a headline, Romano's $15 billion cure, that was supposed to scare us, I guess. According to the paper, this will eat up all of the budget surpluses through 2006. Uncle Don's reaction? So what if it does? What does this government exist for if not to look after the welfare of its citizens? We should remember that the surpluses in the Martin and Manley budgets were produced in spite of the massive amount that we already have to pay in interest on the current debt, and a hell of a lot of that debt was run up by Mulroney in taking care of his corporate friends. I think it would be a just remedy for all of the favors bestowed on the corporate sector to scoop that $15 billion to fix Medicare and to run a surplus to pay down the debt by hitting those that have benefited most from the depredations of Mulroney, the corporations and the rich. Let's get them to pay their fair share as they did 50 years ago. By eliminating some of the tax dodges and deferments that are now given to the rich, we can do it. The Olympics are coming in 2010. Can't you just feel the excitement? For only a couple of $1 billion, we will have 2 weeks of television pictures of jocks from around the world competing for medals and the opportunity to sell their names to Nike for small fortunes. And in the background will be the majesty of Vancouver and Whistler. Our very own impecunious provincial government, the one that cannot fund our schools or medical system, will be spending hundreds of millions of dollars to improve the road that the rich use to travel between work in Vancouver and play in Whistler. When the fortnight of fun is over, the rich will have their private drive, courtesy of those who pay the taxes in the other parts of the province. But there will be others contributing to the cost of the party, so it's not all public money. Some corporations are donating generously. For instance, there have been big donations from BC Hydro, the Insurance Corporation of British Columbia, and other Crown corporations. Let's remember this when we pay the new, higher rates for electricity and the increased insurance fees for our automobiles. I would not be surprised to see that BC Rail, the company that could not afford to maintain our passenger rail service, has given to the cause. This is not to say that Campbell's regime has extorted these contributions from the Crown corporations. That would be unethical and not in the best interest of British Columbians. These corporations that we all own are at arm's length from the current Campbell regime. Forgive me if there was the slightest insinuation of impropriety. Mea culpa. You think the Bible is a dry read? Try eating it. I signed onto a contract while in Australia to work on a construction job in Bougainville, Papua New Guinea. The job did not pay well by our standards, but everything was supplied and it was easy to save almost everything I made. I worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, so there was little opportunity to spend money, even if I had wished to. I kept up a large correspondence, and my greatest expense was stamps. My greatest problem was boredom. I wrote to a friend in California and explained my problem cryptically. My reward was in the mail a couple of weeks later. It was a stolen Gideon Bible from a friend with some inspirational passages suggested on the flyleaf. I knew what that meant. The next Sunday morning, I went to my new Bible for inspiration. I looked up the first passage, tore out the whole page, and ate it. Yuck! Within an hour, half hour, Owsley's magic started to work. Colors began to take on strange hues. My peripheral vision flowed. Everything became weird. The spirit moved me to swim, so I trotted the few meters from my trailer to the gorgeous beach where I snorkeled with a tropical fish over a coral reef. Ah, yes, that biblical passage served me well that day. Another day, and another page from the good book, and I went beachcombing with a very straight friend. I was in a world of my own, wandering in the shallows, turning over rocks, and enjoying the amazing things that we found. We spent the better part of the day on the beach and in the jungle. I was totally spaced, but my friend never suspected a thing. To this day, he does not know that I was tripping. I don't think I would now want to face the strange things that acid does to you. I will consign that sort of adventure to the young and the crazy. Please send comments, threatening letters, and small unmarked bills to Uncle Don. I can be reached, eventually, through CFUR Radio on the UNBC campus at 3333 University Way, Prince George, BC, V2K4Z9. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM. It's confession time for Uncle Don. I own a gun. I don't like guns, including my own. When I was a kid, I used to play guns. When I was around 11 or 12, I had several guns, real ones. A neighbor of mine, whose moment of glory was when he was in the Marines during World War II, took a shine to me. He had two daughters, but he needed a surrogate son, and I was elected. He collected guns. Over a period of time, he gave me a .32 revolver, a .22 sleeve gun, a Japanese officer's gun, and a hand grenade. The .32 was a nasty-looking little piece that he claimed it would not hold a firing pin. I never tested it. The .22 was meant to be carried up one sleeve on an elastic, so a flip of the wrist would drop it into the hand. It held 7 .22 shorts, and I did test that one. The Japanese officer's gun was a miserable piece of pot metal that I would not have tested on a bet. The hand grenade was a souvenir from the Marines, which the neighbor had found wired to his bunk. I gathered that he was not popular with everyone. It was defused, but it was a very scary-looking device. I had a lot of fun with my new toys. My parents did not have the sense to tell him to stuff his gifts. I used to carry the .32 to school and brandish it. If a kid tried that today, he would risk being shot by a cop. One of my teachers was a war vet who used to talk a lot of his experiences. One day he came to class to find everyone seated and quiet. On his desk sat the hand grenade. I don't think a stunt like that would go unnoticed today, either. The point is, we all took guns too casually, even in a suburban neighborhood. Then, at 18, I became a soldier, where I handled serious guns and fired a lot of ammunition. I learned that guns are not toys, and they are designed to kill. I have disliked them ever since. So, why do I have a gun? To kill. I'll tell you why. When I first moved in with my current wife, she was being harassed by her ex-husband. More than harassed, in fact. He set her up for a charge of attempted murder by calling the police and reported that she had taken a shot at him in his apartment. The police found a bullet lodged in his window frame and the pistol that fired the bullet under the seat of her car. The only thing that saved her from doing time was the fact that she happened to be in a criminology class at the College of New Caledonia at the time when he claimed she shot at him. One of her witnesses was the warden of the jail. Sloppy as the justice system is, it is quite easy to frame someone like that. Another time, she was doing a midnight shift at work and came home to find a fire truck in her front yard. Hubby had broken in while drunk. He wrote crazy things on the walls with a marker after trashing the place and then set it on fire. Due to a half-assed investigation and incompetent prosecution, he was convicted only of B&E and given probation and a fine. More justice. After she moved in with me, I told our lawyer that I was planning to buy a shotgun to protect us if he came around. I told him plainly if the man came into our home, I would kill him dead. The lawyer not only loaned me a shotgun of his, but he said he could get me off with a minimal sentence if this should come to pass. Hubby never broke in, and we returned the shotgun. I bought a cheapy single-shot Russian 12-gauge shotgun, and I still have it. I figured a single shot would be plenty, as I would blow him half in two, and that one shot, and that reloading would be unnecessary. I don't like that gun. I don't like any guns anymore, but I recognize they have a place in law enforcement, hunting, and on farms. I do not consider them toys to collect or to play with in target practice. Our beloved government has screwed up royally in the gun registration program. They have blown $1 billion on this whole mess by the time we are finished with it, and still not all guns will be registered. This is a great example of how an idea was run through the bureaucracy, committees, and such, and came up back to front. We have a problem with handguns and automatic weapons in this country. We do not have a problem with long guns that are used for legitimate purposes and which are stored properly. Rather than trying to register every bloody firearm, they should have looked at getting the restricted weapons out of the homes and into the recycling bin. Most of the illegal weapons circulating in Canada were smuggled in from the United States, where the damn things are available in some states as readily as any tool. The next time the Yanks cry about our exporting BC Bud to their precious country, we should tell them to do something about that. We'll do something about that when they find a way to keep all of those guns from crossing our border. Amen. I'm practicing up for a New Year's resolution. Next year, I intend to be less negative in my rantings. As an exercise, I've tried to think of some positive role for Gordon Campbell. It's easy to say that he is destroying this province and selling off its treasures to his rich friends, but there must be a place for such a person in our society. Then it dawned on me. Gordon Campbell would make an excellent organ donor. His liver here, his kidneys there, giving new life to afflicted citizens on the growing medical waiting lists. What a beautiful living tribute to a man who gave his whole being to taking care of his friends. As a bonus, he might find that his cutbacks in medical budgets have exhausted the supply of anesthetics. Sorry, Gord. Here's a bullet to bite. Have a nice day. Argentina has more cattle than people. This country has long been considered the breadbasket of Latin America, exporting large amounts of grain and beef every year. They're still exporting foods, even as their economy is experiencing a collapse. While Argentine beef is being loaded onto transports, there are reports of starvation in some states. Aid workers are finding people, mostly children, with the swollen bellies, blotchy skin, and dry hair that characterize protein deficiency. Why? This, in the country that supplies McDonald's with a good proportion of the makings of their grease burgers? The answer is simple. The International Monetary Fund is demanding that Argentina repay their huge loans in scarce foreign currency, which is available only through huge exports. The poor, the workers, and the marginalized, who are increasingly the same people, of the Argentine society are expected to sacrifice their assets, their labor, and their food to pay the debts of their country. A large part of those debts were run up by the military dictatorship which oppressed, killed, and stole from them for so many years. The International Monetary Fund does not care who turned a prosperous country into a debtor. They just want the money. They don't care if people suffer and die. They just want the money. Why should the people who suffered under a dictatorship have to pay for that dictatorship after democracy has been restored? There's a concept in international law called odious debt, which holds that a people is not responsible for the debts run up by a government unless they benefited from the debt. A good case can be made that the money owed benefited only the military and their corporate allies. Let the corporations and the generals that benefit pay the debts. The same doctrine would apply to many of the international debts owed by the Third World. Let those who chose to lend to the dictators eat those debts, and let the military dictators be brought to justice for their crimes. Of course, this is a pipe dream as long as Bush Light is in charge of the world's hyperpower. They will milk the rest of the world for the last dime with no concern for the citizens. If we object to their rule, we are classified as terrorists and treated accordingly. Information on Argentina and other trouble spots is available. You don't need to cruise exotic databases on the internet to find it. One good source is the Covert Action Quarterly, a well-respected magazine from the United States. It is not cheap at $9 Canadian, but that's because it does not accept advertising. That is worth the extra cost, as it means that the publisher is not beholden to advertisers who would want to influence the content. The Covert Action Quarterly is one of the publications to be found in the PERG office on the Agora at UNBC. Their library is open to the public. Drop in and check it out. The fall edition of the Quarterly has a number of fascinating articles. These are not the stuff of the Prince George Citizen, the National Enquirer, or other periodicals aimed at the grade 8 educational level. Each article is opinionated but factual, and most have footnotes, which are useful if you want to verify content or do further investigating. This latest edition has an article on George Soros, the multi-billionaire who made his money by attacking the currencies of other countries and is who inflicting his right-wing agenda on the world through his supposed philanthropy. Then there's another article on the massacre in Jenin, which contains a chilling quotation from an Israeli military commander that confirms that the tactics used against the Palestinians in Jenin were drawn largely from the Nazis' experience in destroying the Jewish resistance in the Warsaw Ghetto. An article tells about the covert American role in destabilizing the Balkans in order to gain control of its assets and economy. The increasing use of American soldiers in policing within the United States is the subject of another article. Did you know that the United States has given itself the authority to detain foreign citizens outside of the United States without any right of appeal to any courts? That's us, by the way, even here in Canada. Read the article. Argentina is the subject of another lengthy article which tells in detail how the economy of that country has been systematically destroyed by their embracing of neoliberalism, opening of the economy, another triumph for George Bush. There are more good things in this edition, including concluding with an analysis of how the United States is preparing its military machine for World War III, the one designed to crush all of its potential competitors in one fell swoop. Check it out at PIRG on the UNBC campus. Canadians are waking up. A recent poll says that more than half of British Columbians think that George Bush is a greater threat to world peace than Saddam Hussein. The Yanks are gradually becoming isolated. Let's hope that something comes of this. That's it for Uncle Don's program for 11 December. Write if you like it, write if you don't. This is Uncle Don of CFUR, 88.7 FM in Prince George at 3333 University Way, V2N4Z9. If you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own.